Hello and welcome to another episode of the Atlas Podcast. My name's Alex. I'm joined as always by Martin. Hello, Martin.
Hello, Alex.
How are you doing today?
Yeah, good. Good. We've got lots of stuff to talk about today. Too much, really. I think it's going to overspill, but that's a part of the beauty of having too much is then we can elongate things.
Absolutely. We'd always rather have too much than too little. On that note, we've got in the news a UK space launch, which is two things we love, UK and the space. It's also just down the road from us as well, which is nice and exciting.
It's one of those stories which we'll dive into that's kind of probably under the radar, maybe, you know, local, which we like a bit of local, like a little bit of global, but
yeah,
it's one of those things that's slightly under the radar of the news, probably because there's too much depressing news in the world.
Yes. So we'll try and elevate some of the happy stuff.
Exactly. Accentuate the positive.
Absolutely. And then, in our tech spot, we're going to be finishing off, really, our discussion on digital transformation with a discussion on technology, but also probably kicking off another mini-series based off the back of a Gartner report into technology and digital transformation. So that dropped just the right time for us.
Absolutely. So we're going to do a segue, I believe, the transition from one to another.
We are indeed. And finally, we're joined by the manufacturing millennial, aka Jake Hall, who's going to talk about his journey in social media and talking about manufacturing in a way that hasn't really been done before.
And no one can see this, but he smiles all the time, doesn't he? He smiled throughout the whole interview, which was so infectious. You can see why he's a natural for social media.
Made for the camera, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Alrighty, so let's jump in.
Miserable too, aren't we? We're always like, we're grumpy.
I've seen you smile every so often.
We have a chuckle, don't we? We have a chuckle.
Every so often. So the news piece, this actually dropped today. We'll pop a link into the episode description, but I only spotted it today. And it's from the UK space industry. I found it on gov.uk. And Virgin Orbit's carrier aircraft, ground and support equipment and rocket are set to arrive in Cornwall this week ahead of the first satellite launch from the UK. So obviously exciting for us because we're in Exeter, which is just up the road. It's the first satellite launch from the UK. And I know we've been involved obviously in the ESA, and we have astronauts who've been up to the European or the International Space Agency, but I didn't realise that we'd never actually launched anything from our country, basically.
Yeah, and this article is particularly amusing considering it's a government website, but it's got so many buzzwords in here and so many things that they've tried to pack into this article. But it's quite interesting from the fact that they really tried to jazz it up. Maybe, you know, a bit of a press release trying to catch some of the news agents out there. But there's a lot of terminology. Fun things packed into a small article. But it was something that I was aware of because through the manufacturing technology centres and the high value catapult innovation group, a few years ago, I think even before COVID, they'd launched this thing called Space, or they promoted this thing called Space, which I also put a link to with the Innovate UK and the Knowledge Transfer Network. Where they were talking about that a bit more. So that led us to discussing about this approach that the UK is taking, and talking about the setting up of these space ports, of which Newquay's one of those things. I think there's also looking to do one in Scotland as well. And you kind of, at the time when I heard it, I was thinking, well, what are they going to do? Turn this Newquay into Cape Canaveral or whatever this thing is? And it's more clarified, really, with this article that you found, which talks about this Virgin Orbit Cosmic Girl Plane.
Yeah. So the plane is Cosmic Girl. The actual, what is it? The project is Start Me Up, which is a nice Rolling Stones reference. And yeah, it's going from, as you said, Spaceport Cornwall, which sounds very exciting. But it's so funny that it's linked to Newquay, which is a lovely little surfing town, basically. But yeah, it looks like it's the, what they say here, Spaceport Cornwall is the heart of a growing aerospace and space cluster and expects to create 150 jobs in the local area. So yeah, it's one of those, it's exciting and it's fun, but it also produces work because obviously you need people there with very high levels of expertise to carry out the kind of projects that are going to be running from it. And yeah, it's not a rocket launch in the traditional sense, you know. It's not a pad, is it? It looks like, no. I mean, all we have really is the image, but a big jumbo jet with a rocket attached to it. So very similar, I guess, to the Virgin Galactic kind of thing, where they take something up in a traditional plane and that gives it an extra speed boost to then take off and transfer to rocket power and get into orbit.
Yeah, and they talk about 150 jobs in the local area being generated. They talk about 47,000 jobs across the UK in the growing space industry as a vital part of the economy driving forward. So there's a few good statistics there. I think you caught another one as well.
Yeah, it was in the other, from the Knowledge Transfer Network, something I didn't realise until minutes ago. But currently the UK manufactures over 20% of the satellites in orbit, which, considering what a big business it is, you know, one in five being created by the UK is incredible. But considering we're only just launching our first one, it's a funny drop off, perhaps.
It might be more to do with the parts that are manufactured in the UK that go into satellites, I guess. But yeah, it's hard to clarify from the statement what they actually mean by that. But it just shows you that it's a good size of the manufacturing economy, and with various different satellite approaches. One thing I don't know if we touched on before a little bit on maybe the slightly negative side of the story is the space junk in lower orbit. That's one thing we also need to consider as a part of this. They do track a lot of this space junk up in that space or in that area. But yeah, we do have to see that. And some approaches have been trying to deorbit these objects, which necessarily haven't been a safe landing for some of this stuff that comes into the orbit. So we often talk about product lifecycle management, and this is another one of those things I think needs to be considered. How do you dispose of satellites in a safe way that doesn't mean that we're clogging up the space where these satellites orbit, near Earth orbit, preventing future innovations in that space. So that's
it's a very real worry for the future that essentially we could end up trapping ourselves, basically. If there's too much stuff going around, then you don't know whether it would ever be safe to send humans past, obviously, millions of pieces of junk. And then obviously you have the issue that if anything hits anything else, then you have these micro bits of junk that are untrackable and, can cause big problems.
And they're traveling high speeds, you know, back to Newton's law. A small object traveling at high velocity can cause a lot of damage.
A pea going 50,000 miles an hour can do a big, pretty significant issue.
Absolutely.
But yeah, we'll have to find out when it's going. Maybe go down and wave them off.
That's it.
All righty.
We
could watch it from the quay. So TechSpot, we have been talking over the last few weeks about digital transformation and the main pillars, the main steps that go into achieving it, things like structure, things like process. Last week we talked about people. And finally, for a tech spot, we're on to technology. So this is discussing, the technology, considering you've got everything else in place, you've looked at your business processes, you've educated your people, you've looked at the structure of your business, you're sure that everything is ready to go in terms of digital transformation. Now you need the tools in which to enact that. Obviously, that's going to be a mixture depending on the business of IT and operational technology. But there will need to be some sort of technology to facilitate it in the modern world, which I guess is where we're at now.
Yeah, for sure. So we've tried to resist, but we've touched upon it a few times in the previous statements, mainly because I think what people do is the adoption habit of technologies is that people think of the technology rather than these other things first. And if they try and introduce the technology first, the problem is then they come against these other issues that we talked about previously. So then they'd have to iterate back round again. So there is a rhyme to the approach, or reason to the approach, that actually, if you don't do it in that order, you might find yourself iterating back round. And we have seen businesses, you know, pausing these type of projects for several months before they get these things into a line. But you know, people have to learn for themselves a little bit as well, and maybe there's some iterations around that space. So I was going to start, like I said, I was going to start to talk about digital transformation in more of a higher level approach, which was around infrastructure and what we mean by infrastructure, data and applications, and really the different architectures out there, because people talk about, and probably people don't know what a solution architect or an enterprise architect does in these kind of technology landscapes, but they are.
I'll be honest, I did not until I joined Atlas, but now I'm very aware.
And they are a key pivotal part. People are very comfortable about talking about an architect for building a house. Mm-hmm. But there are some huge differences between building products like a house and building IT infrastructure and everything that goes within that technology stack. Because anything we build as a product, we tend to build, fix, debug, snag, whatever we say, and then we use that product. And the only thing that kind of slows it down is the wear and tear of that product, that physical world. In an IT landscape, and especially now we talk about virtualized hardware and infrastructure, because we're really talking about predominantly software in everything, but we'll touch on that a little bit. Is the fact it's about the maintaining of that infrastructure that's the hard thing to do. So it's like building a house and wanting to change it every week, and wanting to move walls around, utilities around all the time. You want to move your waste pipe, your gas supply, constantly in flux and changing. And therefore, you know, it's a very different paradigm to a physical product compared to an IT infrastructure. And what a enterprise architect or a solution architect is about controlling all of that change. So building great foundations and allowing change and innovation to happen within that platform whilst controlling everything about it.
So it
sounds like an almost
bit of a tall order
task. Absolutely. And when you talk about the business, and we talk about the building the business processes, restructuring everything within the concept of the business and the people, all of that change that's happening in a dynamic way has to be represented within an IT infrastructure. So it's a difficult task, and the demands from the business on IT are ever growing, and change is expected to happen quicker and quicker, and we're supposed to deliver value quickly to businesses. And that's why things like these new technology and cloud and data architectures and things like that are being seen as the future for technology in IT. So I'm going to refer back to the report now rather than digging into it too much, because what the report dives into is the things that they believe CEOs or CIOs need from and the trends that they're seeing to create a top strategic approaches.
So this is the Gartner 2020 to top strategic technology trends for 2022.
And they focus on 12 trends that are shaping the future of digital businesses. But mm-hmm. what they're saying is the CEO wants trust in that digital technology for their people and the devices anywhere, you know, which once again is a very broad statement, but trusted digital technology or connections is quite a, you know, is something that people take for granted, given the fact that we talked about all of the things that change constantly, including the security of the platform and environment that's been created. And therefore, it's quite a demanding requirement. The next one that we talked about, solutions to rapidly scale and digital creativity anywhere. You're thinking, oh, okay, right. Solutions.
Yeah.
You know, that rapidly can scale, but allow for creativity and innovation. And that's their third point. Innovative capability to accelerate business growth beyond today. So, you know, sometimes we can look at those statements and think they're a little bit wishy-washy, but they're trying to remove themselves from the this is the answer, you know, cloud is the answer, or this is the answer. These are the challenges when they're talking to CEOs that they think they need for their business to occur. So is more your CEO talk? And that's important because you've got to be able to talk to the right people about their strategic technology trends. And what is the priority? Scale, adoption, and growth are all the priorities. But we've got all of this legacy stuff that we talked about previously that isn't necessarily built on the latest architectures or approaches. So there are lots of challenges there. And the interesting thing here is that they now go into what they consider those 12 technology sectors. So that was what we were talking about earlier, wasn't it, Alex? This is great fodder for us because we can then use this as a way of diving into those 12 things. So we're not going to try and bite off more than we can chew with this, but we will give you a bit of an introduction. Engineering trust is what they first talk about. How can you create great foundations? Yeah. That all of that innovation and change can be built upon. And they talk about it in four ways. The data fabric, so how do you make sure the data is available very quickly and instantly without the issues built around that. They talk about cyber security and more, they call it cyber security mesh. And then privacy enhancement, enhancing computation. So one thing people are talking about is how do you keep data private that needs to be taken private. And all of this, in their mind, is built on cloud-native platforms, which is another thing that we're very, very keen upon. So if you take those four things, they can create the trust that the CEOs are after. Because you've got the security, you've got the data management, you've got the personalization of that data, and then you've got a scalable cloud-native platform. And what I particularly like, and we'll dive into this a bit more in another episode, is the fact that they talk about cloud-native.
Yes.
They specifically talk about not talking about lift and shift migrations. They're talking about SaaS. They're talking about microservices built on SaaS. And they're talking about all the benefits that can come with that. And the one statement I'll leave on that, by 2025, cloud-native platforms will serve as the foundations for more than 95% of new digital innovations, up from 40% in 2021.
Yeah.
That's a huge, huge leap, change of direction that they believe or they're predicting.
Yeah, so, and it's scarily close as well. I keep looking at dates like 2025 and going, oh my God, that's 2 years away, basically.
Absolutely. And that's, I mean, like we said, we took the decision 4 years ago or 5 years ago to look at this kind of cloud-native approach, and that's really where we've been spending a lot of our time and energy in over the last 4 years. And you, once you're involved in that, you can't see there being a better way of doing things.
Yeah, 100%. I think maybe at some point we'll have to come back and talk about the difference between lift and shift and cloud native. Maybe I'll write a little article about it or something and link it in, because it's something that's very new to me as well. I think we discussed earlier off the podcast, people just talk about cloud and think it's a thing, but actually the differences between the applications in it are, it's almost, there's no, the idea of cloud as one thing is almost a misnomer. It's so complex that it's worth dividing up into its various parts.
Absolutely. The second point they talk about is sculpting change, where they look at this thing called compostable applications, which doesn't embrace best phrase, but it's absolutely something that's central to what we're talking about. If you have a cloud microservice architecture approach, then what is an application? Well,
it's more like I have to correct you. Composable applications. I like the idea of compostable applications, but we'll have to invent that ourselves.
Oh, I was going to leave you with the words there, Alex, but I stepped right into my own.
No, it's good. I'm glad.
We learn from our mistakes. then we talk about the decision intelligence, hyper automation, and AI engineering. They're all under the sculpting change part. And like I said, we will dive into these more in future episodes. And accelerating growth, distributed enterprise, which is particularly interesting, I think, about how you distribute enterprise, but I haven't dived into that too much. Total experience, which we're very keen on, which is basically your user experience and how do you get closer to the user and understand the user. Then we've got some more about automating systems and more about AI as well, which is all about how we can move forward. So, so really interesting subjects, and I think that I'd be very keen to dive into those areas. They talk about data, they talk about infrastructure, we talk about the future of what an application is. Because that's a bit abstract in this world as well. So I'd be really keen to talk about that in future episodes.
100%. And yeah, as we mentioned, they've handily broken it down into these three sections as well. So almost tailor-made for us. But yeah, we'll certainly come back to this, because it's funny that it's one of those serendipitous things that happens to drop and just align with a lot of what we've been talking about already. A really, really fascinating package. So yeah, we'll certainly come back to that, probably starting next episode or maybe the one after. But yeah, we'll put some stuff together. Alrighty. I think it's time we jumped into our interview. We recorded this a few days ago with Jake Hall, the manufacturing millennial, as you said, infectious personality, talking about things in a fascinating way. So yeah, we'll jump over there now. And so, for this interview portion of the Atlas podcast, we're joined by Jake Hall, business development manager at Fine Zelstra, keynote speaker and creator of fantastic content that has taught many Atlas employees a thing or two about manufacturing. Thank you for joining us, Jake, on the podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
Fantastic. Yeah, so usually we like to start off with perhaps a bit of your background, how you got into manufacturing, how you found your way here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been in the manufacturing space since I've been a kid. I started working in manufacturing when I was 16 years old, sweeping the shop floor and doing a lot of the grunt work when it comes to manufacturing at a custom machine builder. Went to college, got my product design and manufacturing engineering degrees and biomedical engineering degrees, and went to the college with the idea that, you know, in order to be successful in an industry, you had to go get a four-year degree, which, you know, we're learning is changing. But after college, went to work for an automation distributor where we sold a lot of different types of automation equipment in the manufacturing space. Did that for about 7 years, and then During the pandemic in 2020, a lot of my career changed. One is I joined the team at Fine Zylstra as a business development manager for them. And then at the same time, I started my own, really developing my own personal brand, the Manufacturing Millennial, which I think a lot of people know me on with social media, where I am doing my best to advocate the industry and manufacturing. We're talking about new technologies, the innovations, but also how do we do a better job getting younger generations to be a part of what we do.
So as a part of your journey there, Jake, you talk about, you know, starting sweeping the floors, then going to college, university, and things like that. What was that transition for you? Did you have a burning desire to get more educated back then, or was it you just thought that was the right path to take?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of what the guidance counselor said, you know, I did first robotics, which was, you know, the I guess you could say the sport of the engineer in high school. We built a lot of robots to compete on a playing field. And that time, when we met with the guidance counselor, they said, oh, okay, you like math, you like building things, you like working with your hands. Well, you should be an engineer. And, you know, that was kind of the path that was given to me as the only option to, you know, move forward within my career. So at the time, I went to college for 4.5 years and got a couple engineering degrees.
And now, as a result of that, did that really tick your boxes? Did you find what you thought you were finding? Or was that just like, okay, that's one step. There's something else here I need to explore.
Yeah, I mean, I do not, you know, there's zero regrets going to get an engineering degree. I'm glad I did it. It taught me a lot. I've learned a lot of people. I've had some amazing experiences working for companies during that time, which developed my career. But the one thing that I guess that was interesting for me is, you know, after I got my engineering degree, I really didn't use it in an engineering development design. So I went into sales right away, grabbing out of college. And I think, you know, for me, that's what I always wanted to do, is I love having conversations. I love talking with people. I love interacting with customers and coworkers. So for me, I always knew that I would be more of on the people's side of whatever business. But having that engineering in the background allows me to then take the technical aspects of what we do in this industry and be able to communicate it to the masses in a way that people can understand.
Did someone say to you that, you know, did someone say to you, you should be getting into this type of, you know, after you've gone through the college degree and things like that, your personality, maybe the listeners can't see it, but you're sat there smiling, you've got all of your gear around you, you look like you're really comfortable in your own skin here. And therefore there's a natural exuberance that came with that's coming out of you in this. So was that something people were pointing out, or something you were aware of?
Probably something my father put into me a little bit, because he's in the sales space as well, and he's definitely an extrovert, people person. So I think he was the one that said, hey, Jake, this might be a career path that you might enjoy, just because, you know, like father, like son in a lot of aspects. Mm-hmm. My father knew what I wanted to do and what I wanted to enjoy. So yeah, I guess that's kind of how that goes.
So have you got any one-liners that your dad taught you that you use today? Or is this?
Oh man, not.
You're on the spot now.
I don't know if I necessarily have the one-liners, but definitely, you know, the personality definitely runs off the same dry jokes, the same laughing at stuff, the same type of you know, giving attitude, I would say definitely is a direct reflection of my father.
And so the interesting thing there was, you talked about the pandemic and the, I guess, the rise of us all working from home, very familiar with using videos to talk to people in your business development role. Did that have a change in your approach when the pandemic came along, and that led you to this kind of, you know, the manufacturing millennial tagline that you so well embodied?
Yeah, I mean, so the manufacturing millennial, the idea came around 2019 or so, when I was at an automation conference, and I was sitting in a room of about 400 other business leaders. And as I looked across that room, you know, Martin, I was probably the only person there in the age of 40. And I said, this is crazy. This is a leadership meeting talking about what's happening in our future in manufacturing. And we have no youth as a part of this future. So the idea then is, you know, I'm a millennial. I'm in manufacturing. I'm going to go and advocate it from however I can. And then I left that event and then did absolutely nothing. But about 6 months later, when the pandemic hit in the spring of 2020, and we had this mandatory work from home here in Michigan where all non-essential people needed to be at home doing their job, I immediately thought, well, no one else is going to be – no, everyone's going to respond, you know, for a while with emails and phone calls at home, but then no one's going to want to do that anymore. So I said, okay, I need to get in front of these people in a way that's more of a authentic type of engagement where my face and my name is always in front of them, even if it's not through a sales call. So I turned to LinkedIn saying, you know what, LinkedIn, I have like 115 connections on LinkedIn at the time. I'm going to start using this as a platform to connect with all of my connections and people who I work with in real life and start just sharing content. And I had no ambitions to go out there and share and be a content creator or an influencer at first with that. But then after I got going and I was getting into it for a month or so, I said, okay, there's some engagement here. There's some really good conversations. There's people who are outside my network engaging with my content and the way I'm creating content. Maybe I start advocating more about what youth should be like in our industry as a platform. And then from there, it kind of just took off. You know, I would get 1,000 new people who would follow me a month. And then 6 months later, I had 10,000 people. And, you know, 2 years later, about where I'm at right now, I'll be pushing 50,000 people by the end of this year with 50 million views on content. And I think what's exciting is there was never any ambitions to be in the position I am today. But now that I am in that position, I'm definitely going to do what I can to get our future youth excited about it and drive awareness to manufacturers and companies why it's so important to change how you do business to attract a future workforce by embracing technology and innovation and the new way of doing manufacturing. So yeah, that's kind of how things got kicked off and got going. And 2 years later, it's in the position I am today.
So is it something you had ever had experience with before? I mean, content creation, making videos or anything like that? Or was it very much you reacted to a situation and it's just been learning on the job?
Yeah, I reacted to a situation. I used this thing called YouTube.com to teach me how to video edit, to teach me about lighting and to teach about sound stuff. And, you know, beforehand, I was showing you guys my computer setup here where I have a DSLR camera as a webcam and I have other webcams and I have a Stream Deck where I can switch between different views or share screens. And I have, you know, a professional audio recording device and like a bunch of different lighting. This is all stuff that I just taught myself. Because I knew it was one of those things that I needed to continuously improve. And I think that's what is so relatable to younger generations of millennials and Gen Zs is they can go out there and they can learn stuff through the power of the internet and through video. And, you know, that's why I love just talking about the same things in person when I get to travel around and go and speak at places is to talk about, listen, this new youth that is going to be in manufacturing is ambitious. They are very highly educated and knowledgeable, you know, but if you don't give them the tools and the resources for them to grow and improve your company, you know, you're not going to be keeping them around.
One thing that we talk a lot about on the podcast is manufacturing engineering can be a very inward looking industry, which is obviously counter to what you're doing. Have you noticed in the last couple of years off the back of increased visibility on you and what you're doing, anyone else springing up to do the same kind of thing? Or have you noticed rubbing up against people with that traditional idea? Or
Well, I mean, I see a lot of other people, you know, seeing what I'm doing and then creating their own personal brand and their own story and, you know, doing the same thing. They're advocating what they're passionate about in the manufacturing space. If it's through workforce, if it's through robotics or the adaption of AI or machine learning with vision. There's so many different other areas, but I think what we're doing now is we are in the past year or so seeing a lot more companies understand the value of what social media can do to drive our industry forward. For the longest time, our marketing in this space to each other from a B2C and a B2B perspective was, I'm just going to publish my latest case study, one-page article, or create a two-minute company history video as the only content I make. And those times are changing because I think a lot of people want to better understand the individual and the authenticity of who that company is from a personal level, not just from a corporate. And I think we're seeing that translate from a lot of other industries. What I'm doing in manufacturing, I see as a lot of other influencers doing in a lot of other different industries. And there's influencers in consumer goods and cell phones and tablets and makeup and baseball and Lego. I mean, literally every single, you know, business or hobby or product, there are influencers in the space, but there really never was in manufacturing. And I think that just shows how far of a time we were behind at one point, and we still are in a lot of cases when it comes to the power of the individual and the relatability that they can take with other people.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing you talked about there. I think with other industries have done this, they have now become more detailed, haven't they? There'll be niches. We're not even in the niche phase here. We're very much still in the manufacturing. Is that one big block, manufacturing? Or is there more to manufacturing than this great big one block? And, you know, there's so much involved in that.
And the fact that manufacturing is not just this dark, dirty, dangerous, dull industry anymore. It's an industry that is filled with technology. It's an industry that's filled with information and analytics and data that we can act on. And as we move from an industry that's so focused on, at one point in time, the product and not necessarily the people as a part of that, you know, that's something like why I love what I do at Find Zelstra, because we can focus on how do we leverage existing systems and make them smarter for companies to better understand how those machines can be used to increase productivity. So, I mean, that's why it's such a fun tie-in with what I do at my day job and then being active on LinkedIn. There's so many opportunities that come across my door and my path on LinkedIn that work with me at Find Zelstra, where companies reach out and say, hey, Jake, I saw you talk about this or this or productivity or OEE or analytics or better visibility with how our processes work. And, you know, we can then tie that into what I do for my actual job with Find Zelstra as well.
So there is a point to that, really. Again, you do have a job, day job as well. You're not just the manufacturing millennium on the social media scene.
Yeah. And it's fun that way because I truly think, you know, relationships are won by – well, jobs are won by relationships at the end of the day. And I think it's, you know, it's for them understanding who you are. And if me, if I can be authentic with what my passion is, which is advocating manufacturing as well as working with manufacturers to increase productivity and make their systems more reliable and less of a risk, I think there's a direct relationship and correlation between those two.
Well, in the end, people buy from people. That's the kind of concept that you're advocating. And you also talked a little bit about technology. We haven't touched on it much, but one of my favorite phrases around the industry for is the adoption of internet technology into the industrial domain. And you're talking about internet marketing or you know, persona-based selling. So that's one way of adopting internet technologies and approaches into the industrial domain. But what about purely from a technology point of view? What do you think is manufacturing missing out on that is widely available in the internet domain that they could adopt?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is just accessibility to understanding what their machines are doing. We focus so much on the capital costs of equipment to buy another machine that's going to make us, you know, produce 50% more of our capacity than we currently are. But I feel like a lot of times manufacturers are truly missing out on the opportunity to understand what their current machine is doing and what the analytics of how productive their machine is. And if we could go out there, we could give them a better understanding of what their processes look like, we could help them improve dramatically in a lot of areas where it's not the cost of just buying a brand new piece of equipment. I think a lot of times as well, when you look at the youth perspective of what they view manufacturing as, if we can give them a better understanding of what their impact and purpose is in manufacturing, I think the best way to show that is through analytics, for them to see that, oh, if I made 60 parts per hour, I could see that I was 10% above my job quota for that year. And I could see that, hey, my direct work affected the company this way, or when the machine was down, it affected it this way. And I think information is the best way for people to understand what their direct impact is.
Yeah, because it comes about outcomes, really, doesn't it, in the end, doesn't it? So if people get value through those outcomes that they feel like they're achieving with that, then there's one thing. So what other kind of image problems do you see that manufacturing has that maybe, you know, you're trying to break down?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me is the adoption of new technology, where I am a firm believer that automation and robots and solutions like that are here to make jobs better. They're not here to replace jobs. Right now in the United States, there's somewhere between 700,000 to 800,000 open jobs in manufacturing right now, and we're having a hard time fulfilling those jobs. Mm. When you look at the numbers from 2021, we went from a 3% unfulfilled labor industry to a 7% unfulfilled labor industry in manufacturing, which basically reflected in us losing $100 billion in manufacturing output here in the U.S. last year. $100 billion.
It's not insignificant.
And yeah, it's no small number, but what if we were able to leverage automation in a way to help a lot of these small to medium-sized businesses, these companies who are under 500 employees that represent a majority of it. You know, here in the United States, and I'm pretty sure it's relative in the EU as well, 98% of manufacturers here in the US qualify as a small to medium-sized business. Mm. 70% of them are under 50 employees. So I think it's one of those things is, I think technology in a lot of areas is the equalizer that allows small manufacturers to be competitive in a global economy. Because they can then, as a small machine shop, leveraging a collaborative robot or leveraging a SCADA system to get them better insights on how 50 of their machines are running across the board. That is the equalizer, is technology, to make them competitive in an area where they're competing not against just the neighbor down the street, but the person across, you know, the ocean as well. And hopefully that technology allows them to, you know, continue to grow and then keep the people that they have working for them employed, because that's just what's going to keep the doors open is technology.
And you got one of
What's the blocker there? Is it? Oh, sorry, Martin. Go on.
You go.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah. What do you see the blocker as there? Is it the access? Is it people knowing that technology is out there, or is there technology smaller enterprises might need not there for them?
I think there's a few things. I think one is there's always a happy entry to change, you know, where people don't want to do things because this is the way they've always used to do it. I would say the other thing as well that we're seeing in our space is, let's just use robots as an example. A long time, you know, for many years, industrial robots were a heavy capital investment that a lot of times wasn't just the robot, but that was the entire machine and infrastructure around that system. A lot of times you needed to have a controls engineer or a robot engineer who went to college, who had a lot of experience, had an engineering degree, went to go get training and all that stuff. And it was a big investment from a company's perspective. And a lot of times those small to medium-sized businesses then couldn't justify the cost of what that investment looked like, especially for the labor that you had to hire to maintain that. Fast forward to today, with the adoption of machine learning and AI and the advancements in collaborative robotics, you can now program a robot with an iPad type setup, and you can then have all of these different tools and solutions plugged into the same ecosystem where they just work together. So now by this technology enablement, we're dramatically reducing the risk from the small to medium-sized business, where they don't need to have a full-time robot or controls engineer on staff. you know, a maintenance guy who understands some basic problem solving can now program a robot to do machine tending or machine handling or palletizing in a way that just simplifies things so much easier. I think the same thing when it comes to information and software as well. Software has become so much more accessible in how we program things and how we do things and how we can plug in a sensor to a machine and immediately get preventative maintenance or condition monitoring on a part or a process, that you just literally take two buttons, you push them together, and then all of a sudden you can read the temperature and vibration on a motor and have your own condition monitoring system running with alarms within 30 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, that technology is what's enabling a lot of companies to be a lot more productive and a lot more competitive in how our economy is moving forward.
So what's next for the manufacturing millennium? You've cut your teeth on this whole influencer space, and there's lots of space still to grow, as many other industries have said. So what's on your roadmap moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, right now I am heavy on the road right now. You know, as we're recording this podcast, last week I was in North Carolina and Cedar Rapids. The week before that, I was in Chicago. This week, I'm in Texas. Next week, I'm in Boston. So, you know, traveling around, doing a lot of presentations, a lot of, you know, meeting a lot of different manufacturers and companies. So, you know, it's exciting to have that as my near journey ahead.
Excellent. So you've gone from the home working environment that created the manufacturing millennium to the real physical manifestation, getting out of there.
On a plane from place to place, absolutely.
Brilliant stuff. So, yeah, it's been so interesting.
Excellent stuff.
We've had lots of people. We've had, you know, entrepreneurs. We've had really technical people. But it's great to really get to know someone who's having a big impact in manufacturing by just embracing that whole influencer space and sharing their ideas with everybody, including the youth of today. So yeah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, as we said,
it was a pleasure, guys.
Yeah, for an industry that looks in, it's always nice talking to people who look out as well. All right, thank you so much for joining us, Jake. We'll hopefully speak to you again soon.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Martin.
That's it for another episode of the Atlas Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me, Martin.
Thank you very much. like I said, I felt like we skimmed over some of that stuff around technology, but we like to keep a little bit, keep them wanting more, maybe, hopefully, and dangling a few lovely bite-size future nibbles for people to...
100%.
Mixed
metaphors in one sentence. Alrighty, yeah. So we'll be back in a couple of weeks with some more news, new interviews, and perhaps a bit more about technology, hopefully.
Excellent. I look forward to Alex.
For more information on Atlas and the projects we're involved in, head over to weareatlas.com. And to keep up to date with us, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at ats_Atlas and on LinkedIn at ats-Atlas.